Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, I want to give my thanks to the Hellenic Observatory and Professor Featherstone, who have given me the opportunity to deliver the main speech for the 10th anniversary of the Observatory. I asked to speak about the developments in Greece for the last 20 years and where is Greece now in the European Union. Being believed probably on one of the oldest alumni of the LSE in this room, I feel particularly happy to participate at this event. May I mention, therefore, one of my first experiences at the LSE in 1962. I visited the seminar of Robert McKenzie, a well-known professor, who said to the students the first day of the seminar, "All of you will assume important duties in your countries you come from. You will become ministers and prime ministers. The most important is to hold a diary. It's the only way to remember what really happened." The advice was sound, but I did not keep a diary because I was not expecting to become minister or prime minister. The 20-year period from 1996 to 2016 is marked by the contradictions that characterize the Greek society. From 1994 to around 2006, Greece experienced high growth rates and economic stability. The Greek economy during these years grew at an average rate of 3.5% of GDP, five times greater than the 0.7%, which was the average for the period 91-93, and significantly above the EU average. Inflation, previously in two figures, was drastically reduced. Budgetary policy also succeeded in bringing the deficit down to a much lower level than was usual in the past. There was an increase in private investment and an inflow of foreign capital. By the end of 2003, Greece's international standing had risen drastically compared with the preceding decade. The efforts made to actively participate in European developments had gained international recognition. The project of bringing Greece up to par with its major European counterparts had not, of course, been completed. There is no end to a project that can solve all matters with a magical policy. There is no end date to the project of modernization. Reform is an ongoing and incremental process. There were still many challenges and shortcomings that remained unresolved in 2003-2004. Regardless of who took the reins of power after the 2004 elections, further was required to stabilize the economy and structural change was needed to modernize the country. Greece could not afford to have the luxury of resting on its laurels and taking a break. There was no time to take a step back and admire the progress made. In 2007, a rapid downturn began. In the following 2 years, the deficit grew and reached in 2009, 15.4% of GDP, a record figure. This inordinately large deficit was a result of the handout policy adopted by the new government in 2004, growth entered also in an unprecedented crisis. GDP plummeted by some 25% between 2009 and 2015. The European Union and the International Monetary Fund intervened, granting Greece a succession of loans from 2010 onwards. Greece signed three memoranda of understanding in 2010, 2012, and 2015 in order to get the loans. These agreements, the memoranda, contain detailed instruction on the policy Greece must perform and pursue. The compliance to the instruction was and is still a condition for the disbursement of the loans. Greece is not yet in a position to borrow from the markets at the current rate of interest. The public debt has risen to 318 billion euros, around 180% of GDP. Two factors led to the Greek crisis: economic backwardness in Greece and the disparity between levels of development in the north and the south of the Union. The Greek economy suffered from numerous serious structural problems that persist today, despite years of efforts to solve them. To mention a few: the continual decline in competitiveness, dysfunctional state administration, rising public spending, mismanagement and poor organization of the goods and service markets, lack of flexibility in the labor market, and mainly the political system of patronage that dominate public life. All these problems contributed to the difficulties Greece experienced in adjusting to international developments and sustained the gulf in terms of growth between Greece and the core of its fellow members in the Eurozone. Political patronage and the extent of trade union influence inhibited any genuine chance of modernization and jeopardized the possibility of convergence with the core countries of the Union. This is the first cause. The second main cause of the downward spiral of the Greek economy is the difference to the level of development between Greece and its partners, inherent to the single currency area created by the European Monetary Union. It concerns the magnitude of the divergence between growth rates in the north and the south, the poor competitiveness of the peripheral countries, and the large deficits in their balance of payments. From 2000 to 2007, Greece's annual trade deficit was 8.4% on average. Portugal was 9.4% on average, while Germany had a surplus of 3.2% and the Netherlands of 5.4%. To cover these deficits, the peripheral countries have been obliged to borrow, first from the private sector and then from the member states. But the Greek government failed to explore what limits it should set to avoid future problems. The European Commission was also responsible for the disaster that befell Greece under the regime of external fiscal supervision from 2004 onwards. The commissioner, who was responsible, accepted the data submitted by the Greek government without raising any serious opposition. He did not even voice a protest in 2009, when the figures for 2008 and 2009 were not submitted. His silence was probably conscious. He did not want the deficit to become a problem for the Conservative government in the upcoming Greek elections of 2009. The three memoranda, each of them for different reasons, have not succeeded in radically changing the situation. The main failing was the application of shock tactics that were unsuited to existing conditions in Greece. The state machinery was not ready to implement the necessary reforms immediately. The government, which was unwilling to restrict expenditure and committed to various promises it had made to the public sector and the broader electorate, repeatedly taxed income and reduced pensions and salary, but not the public expenditure and the expenses for the clientelistic policies. Poverty and distress spread to large sections of the population. The extremely rapid reduction of income mobilized massive popular dissent against the memoranda. The government lacked the political will and strength to take on such political pressure. It abandoned the reforms. The most spectacular failure of the first memorandum was the forecast of recession. Initial calculations indicated it would not exceed -7.5% of GDP. It reached approximately -23% of GDP, three times greater than had been the forecast. The third memorandum instituted a special regime for Greece. All the extraordinary regulations that were already in force or were then decided upon ceased to be temporary. Thenceforth, they would apply indefinitely. Greece now belongs to a new class of member states, that of economically backward states. One example of this is the creation of a fund to hold all the significant assets of the Greek state so they can be sold off in future. This arrangement will remain in force for 99 years. As to when the crisis will end, complete uncertainty reigns. According to the calculations of the Greek government and the creditors, growth will resume in 2017. The drop in GDP that was caused by the crisis will be covered by around 2030. However, there can be no certainty as to what will happen more than a decade from now. Only one thing is certain. Greece must make tremendous efforts in the immediate future to more stabilize the economy and modernize. Critics of the memorandum maintain that if a Keynesian model has been adopted rather than one of the stringent austerity, then economic activity would have been sufficiently stimulated to propel Greece out of a recession and crisis. The main problem, they say, was liquidity. However, the Greek deficit and debt were out of all proportion to the country's productive capacity and ability to produce wealth. Not one of those who criticized the strict fiscal discipline ever claimed that it would be possible to stabilize the economy without reducing deficits and debt, as well as enacting structural changes and broader reforms of the state's modus operandi. Differing views inevitably existed and exist of how best to promote adjustment, but that an over-indebted nation close to bankruptcy needs to be put in order cannot be contested. In May 2010, when the first memorandum was agreed, the euro area was not interested in long-term solution to the Greek problem. What it wanted above all was to forestall a Greek default, thus saving the banks that had granted massive loans to Greece. it was the unofficial version, that of saving the banks, that proved to be true, rather than the official version, that of saving Greece, and mainly saving French and German banks. Thanks to the Eurozone bailout, Greece repaid its debts to European banks, repaying them with money from the partners, converted Greece's debts to the banks into debts to the Eurozone member states. Thus, the euro area gained the time to take a closer stock of the situation. But in order to deter other member states from incurring excessive debts, it treated Greece with great severity, demanding the implementation of extremely stringent fiscal policy. They wanted the solution imposed on Greece to be a warning to any countries that did not control their deficits according to the EU rules. But they counting on re-evaluating the penalty when Greece was in better shape. Suddenly, however, problems emerged in the economies of Portugal, Ireland, and Spain. The danger of a broader crisis in the euro area became apparent. There had already been one resulting from the securities fiasco in the U.S. in 2008. The Eurozone wanted, therefore, in 2011-2012, to avoid another, at all costs, another crisis. Efforts to deal with the Greek crisis had to be incorporated into an all-embracing plan. But no such plan was to hand. Initial notions of re-examining the Greek issue were postponed in favor of finding ways of tackling the overall crisis. A more tolerant stance towards Greece seemed risky. Since then, some modifications have been made to the Eurozone's overall policy on Greece, as can be seen in the second memorandum and debt restructuring, the PSI of 2012. But the strict approach prevailed, as the third memorandum indicates. After the onset of the Greek crisis in 2008, the conservative position was dominant in the EU. It was widely held that the Lisbon Treaty of 2007, contained all necessary changes to the EU's institutional framework, and no further reform should be sought. There were various reasons for this. The accession of 10 new member states in 2004 multiplied the difficulties in consultations and decision-making in the EU. These new member states have reacted against unifying efforts and new rules. From 2001 onwards, the composition of the European Council began to change. The social democratic majority was gradually replaced. Governments were elected in Germany, France, and Italy that no longer nurtured the same interest in European affairs. Their focus shifted toward internal concerns. The European Commission underwent a shift in composition, reflecting this trend, with conservative commissioners becoming increasingly dominant. The line, "No more changes, there have been enough," a saying of Mr. Barroso, expressed the position of both member states and EU institutions. Policies for growth and initiatives to reduce the imbalances between member states were considered unsuitable. The increase in funds for the EU budget so that new projects could be launched met with intense resistance. There was no vision. The EU suffered from short-termism. The Franco-German axis established its own order, of which the dominant policy concern was fiscal discipline and its expression, the fiscal compact. The climate was hostile to agitators, causing trouble by sowing doubts about the EU edifice. The fault was perceived to lie with them, the agitators and not the union. Significant difficulties continue to impede the task of overcoming the crisis expressed by the poor growth in the union in recent years, coupled with very low inflation, significant efforts by the European Central Bank to revitalize economic activity through an unprecedented expansion of funding for banks, which, however, as we all know, had limited access. Throughout the Union, these problems have sparked doubts about the policy it has pursued. The migrant crisis brought to a head doubts as to whether the Union can solve its problems while operating as it currently does. It is generally believed that the EU has not yet designed a rounded policy of economic governance, a new way of dealing with imbalances between the developed core and the less developed periphery. The Union has not formulated procedures for the systematic promotion of economic growth that would distribute benefits to all members in as balanced a way as possible. A plan for the future is needed, one that will allow faster and more decisive decision-taking in the EU. A plan for modernization, if I can use your terms. There is an evident lack of central guidance and the absence of a truly inclusive way of getting all member states to pull in the same direction. Developing a coherent policy that will confront the causes of grave imbalances and new problems is now imperative. Such a policy requires much closer economic and political cooperation and will lead to gradual inter-European integration. European integration is all the more necessary because of globalization, which has greatly enhanced the ability of markets to guide and determine policy. The balance of power between markets and politics has tipped steadily in favor of markets. The Greek crisis is a classic example. The markets forced the euro area to bail Greece out by continually raising interest rates, until Greece could no longer borrow from the banks. Greece received in 2010 a funding of 110 billion euros, precisely the sum it owed to the Eurozone banks. Integration will take time. Both Germany and France will hold elections in 2017. The discussion of integration presupposes that governments will have time at their disposal to negotiate and reach decisions. This is why the European Council denies today that there is any question of changing the way the Union operates. The Council wants to win time. In a communique it issued after its June meeting in 2016 in Brussels, the Council denied that there was a question of whether there should be more or less union, more or less Europe. European citizens, said the Council, expect better results from us on matters of security, employment and development. They want their hopes for a better future to have solid foundations. The communique is silent on the subject of how those better results are to be achieved. The communique is silent on what the solid foundations have to be. Improving the operation of the Union, and indeed in the direction of greater solidarity, is impossible without transferring funds from the center to the periphery or imposing an EU tax on company profits. Achieving better results necessitates extensive negotiation and inevitably the difficulty the difficult matter of changing the treaties. More and closer cooperation among European countries is a necessity. This goal implies the need for common action and acceptance of the inevitability of a shared future in an ever-changing globalized world in which new possibilities have an increasing determining presence. There are many different ways of furthering European integration, and many different ways have been proposed. Some suggest radical changes. Others prefer a mild adjustment. The summer of 2016, the French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault and his German counterpart Frank-Walter Steinmeier described the main challenges that Euro must address. The primary issue is the security of the Union's member states. Europe is a security union. It is based on mutual assistance between member states in support of common security and defense policy. To enable it to meet that objective, Germany and France proposed the conclusion of a European Security Compact. The need to combat terrorism is urgent. In the immediate term, we must aim, according to the two ministers, to a European platform for intelligence cooperation, data exchange, contingency planning for major crisis scenarios affecting several member states, and the establishment of a European Civil Protection Corps. According to the report of the ministers, the next vital issue is requiring a joint approach, that of asylum and migration possibly, that covers asylum and migration policy. The principle of solidarity mandates that the burden must be shared among the member states in accordance with their capabilities. However, given the need for immediate solution, we should not rule out the possibility of a group of member states that share a common sense of responsibility making progress on common policies. The third issue is that of fostering growth and the completion of economic and monetary union. We must advance on three fronts simultaneously to strengthen economic convergence, enhance social justice and democratic accountability, and lastly, improve defenses against crisis so as to safeguard the irreversibility of the euro. Fostering growth requires initiatives in strategic sectors such as energy, the digital sector, research and vocational training. The European Fund for Strategic Investment is essential. In support of the euro, the European Stability Mechanism must establish a special tax so that the euro area acquires its own resources and we can make progress on promoting common taxation policy. This proposal is, I think, the most realistic proposal from the many, many that have been presented. It correctly avoids spelling out a minutely detailed integration program to be implemented in predetermined steps with a set time for the completion of each stage. A rigidly defined process would entail conducting endless negotiations and making constant exceptions for states that insist of having their way. In current circumstances, integration can only come about gradually, issue by issue. Existing shortcomings and the dynamics of growth will lead to different levels of integration. Thus, the shared network that covers all the Union will differ in density according to each issue. An example, the Common Agricultural Policy has been in existence for some time. It's a common policy. All member states apply it. A common taxation policy, however, has yet to be formulated, though it is far more important than the agricultural policy. Along the way, maybe groups of states that cooperate closely with each other than all the member states together, as well as special cases of state with their own particular regime, will develop. The overarching system will be managed formally by single center, but will in effect be led by a core of more economically powerful states. The European Union has experienced many crises. It has overcome them, and not by chance. Coexistence and cooperation are both a recipe for economic and social developments and the result of them. In this globalized age, we cannot develop and expand social justice in Europe without continuing and deepening the common project. Greece is not doomed to lag behind. Another way is possible. Participation in the European integration, globalization, technological change, and the extensive interaction of Greeks with the economies and culture of other countries all entail social, economic, and political opportunities for a different course from the present one. Powerful forces are striving in Greece to pursue the path of renew and reform. I hope they succeed. Thank you.